I want to share that with you. The next thing I want to share with you is I want to introduce our speaker tonight. I'm grateful, man. Okay. And I've been privileged to be in this woman's life for the last 25 years. And today is her 29th birthday. So I want to invite her up so I can give her a good old N.A. hug. You can. And I have a chip. Jerry G.
Damn, I thought I had sucked it up pretty good, you know? I'm Jerry Manatic. Oh, man. So, I kind of got to pull my shit together here. Hang on. Okay, so I want to welcome those of you that are new to Narcotics Anonymous. I saw a lot of people standing up for days and 30 days and 60 days, and not that all of you other people that were standing up, which I think amazingly, almost every single year somebody stood up. I think there was only like two or three years there that were called out that people didn't stand up. And that's pretty awesome, because in all the time I've been clean, there's usually this huge gap between 5 years and like 15 years, or, you know, like where there's like this big void. So something is going on around here that's good, right? And if you're new, I hope that you saw a message of hope as people stood up, you know, and celebrating their recovery. Sometimes I think what I have today is not of my own will, because I have, I think, not intentionally, but I think there's been many times in my life, in my recovery especially, where I have sabotaged a lot of my good fortune. So knowing that I'm standing here still clean is kind of a miracle. Couldn't have done it without the 12 steps and an awesome sponsor and people around me that love me. So I guess I just hope that if you're new, nobody, at least that I know, stays clean for any long period of time in isolation. So if you think that you can just shut yourself off from the rest of the universe and just not use, you might be able to do that for a little bit of time, but if you're anything like me, you will be stark raving crazy in a very short period of time. And I have done that throughout my recovery. There have been bouts off and on where I have retreated and isolated and had to pull my head out my ass and come back. You know, thank God I didn't use in that time. When I first got to Narcotics Anonymous, I'm going to probably sound like a historical book here, so pardon me, but just a little bit. When I got clean, there wasn't an NA meeting every day. So if you wanted to do 90 meetings in 90 days, which is what I did, first of all, let me say, when I was told that I needed to do that, I thought, you guys must not have a life, right? Because, like, I got one and I couldn't do that. And I want you to know that once I stopped using and shucking and jiving and trying to find the bag and doing all that stuff, there was a lot of time. Go figure. So my one meeting a day sometimes turned into two or three a day, because sometimes one day at a time was too long. Sometimes it was All I got to do is just get in the shower and don't use. Call somebody, don't use. Get to the next meeting, don't use. And so, you know, we had to travel. We had to travel to meetings. I know, this is like, I walked 100 miles in the snow to my school, but that's really kind of what it was like. The awesome part about that is that we had a lot of those meetings before the meetings and the meetings after the meetings. My first Narcotics Anonymous meeting was on Thursday night in Tulare. It was called the Get Along Game. I think it's still going on. And it was held at a big house out in the middle of the country. And there was a couple that had basically on their own started an inpatient recovery home for people that needed to get clean. They had really no outside funding. It was kind of a miracle that they were able to help so many people. But they had these meetings at their it was called the ranch. Go figure. And sometimes the meeting would grow so big we'd have to have the meeting outside because we couldn't fit inside. But the funny thing that happened for me, just to back up a little bit, is the way I got exposed to Narcotics Anonymous. I was actually attending Naranon meetings. And for those of you that don't know, it's the sister program to Narcotics Anonymous for those people that have codependency issues but aren't addicts. Now, mind you, my brother was using heroin. My mom and dad were both still active alcoholics. And I had decided that if I went to Naranon, I could figure out how to fix all these people that were making me crazy. And then my life would be okay. But I was doing lines before I went, and I was on the way to bar afterwards. And all of those people that were my problems, they got clean. So, what do you think happened? My life was still shit. And so I went to, at the time I was a full-time hairdresser, I went to a hair show that day with a girlfriend of mine who ultimately came into Narcotics Anonymous with me. She was my drug dealer. It helped a little bit that I stayed clean because brought her with me. So I went to this hair show and I got home, and it was my brother's belly button birthday. I don't know what year it was or anything. I just know that it was 29 years and a few days ago. And all those people that were my problems, they were all okay. And I was pretty toasted when I walked in the door. And honestly, it was a way out of them looking at me that I said, you know, hey, why don't you take me to one of those meetings? You know, like, you know, diversion tactic. And so my brother said, well, you know, there's one on Thursday night we'd like to go to if you want to go to that, blah, blah, blah. Now, I had to then tell my parents that I was going to go to a meeting. And they thought I was crazy because, you know, I wasn't the one that had a problem. See, because I had played the role of the golden child in my family most of my life. So my mom was like, why are you going to another meeting, you know? And I said, well, you know, I'll probably find me some nice guy that's clean out there. I know, you guys are all laughing. I know, it's funny. I know, it is funny. But at the time, I thought that was an opportunity. And so I came to my first meeting really because I just wanted the attention off of me. And when I got to that meeting, it was a house, so I rang the doorbell. And, you know, it was a meeting. Like, you don't ring the doorbell. So my brother's like, oh, my God, who's that effing newcomer? And there's his sister, you know. I was welcomed by some awesome people that I remember sitting in that room in these, they were folding plastic chairs, best I could remember. And I remember feeling like if everybody was looking at me, that I was probably visibly shaking. But the truth was, is I think that I wanted what people had, and I was afraid I wasn't going to get it. I wanted to be accepted, and I was afraid I'd be rejected. So I left that meeting that night, which was October 6th, and I drank because I just didn't want... I guess I was trying to prove that I didn't belong or something. But by the next day, I realized that every single thing that I heard in that meeting applied to me. Now, my brother, like I said, got clean a year before I did. Actually, a little more than a year before I did. And I remember the first birthday, when he celebrated his first birthday, I wasn't clean. And so I went to this meeting to support him. And so I had to, like, prove to my family that I wasn't going to be a loser, you know. So I worked really hard to not be another 90-day Dave, because that was my brother's moniker for a long time, you know. He'd go in and come out and go in and go out, and so did Rick. You know, he's shared that. I'm not giving up his story at all. But so I, you know, the golden child that I am, I have to prove that I can do this better than my brother. Not that there's any competitive nature in me at all, but anyway... when I started going to a meeting every day, we had really small meetings. This would have been considered almost like a convention-sized meeting. Our meetings were five or six people. We'd get really sick and tired of hearing each other's stories. You know, somebody new would walk in and, you know, poor bastard would be like, "You want a chair?" You know? "Oh, I'm not even clean." "That's all right. You can just share what you got, man. It's fine." Because we were just so sick of hearing ourselves, you know. And there wasn't very many women in Narcotics Anonymous at that time. I think in most of the meetings that I attended, there was two or three people. Noreen came later, and I'm really grateful to see her with a little bit of clean time when she arrived. My sponsor at the time, I think she had 7 years. Unfortunately, she didn't stay clean. And there were a few other women sprinkling around, but most of the meetings were primarily men. And so finding a sponsor was not that easy. And I kind of vowed to myself that, you know, part of my motivation to stay clean after a while was because I felt like if I could put together some clean time, that it, you know, would be a benefit to those coming in after me to have some women to be able to reach out to. Because most of the women were in another fellowship. And I know that's probably not popular to say, but at the time, that was what was going on. And, you know, so I'm grateful for all of those people. I have friends on every side of the camp, and I love them all. And I love Narcotics Anonymous, but I also love all of my friends. And those people saved my ass. And I don't want to turn my back on my friends, you know. I have a sponsor now who has a sponsor. I went through a few sponsors. I had a sponsor actually that I was dating this guy and we broke up. We were at a world convention in Oregon. I'll never forget that. And I won't give you all the details because it'll just bore you to death. But basically what ended up happening was on the way home, I thought, what, one of those holy mother of God, what have I done kind of relationships, you know, and here I am in a sea of addicts, and I get on the phone and call my sponsor because I think she's going to save me, and it's not the sponsor I have today, but she chose his side. When I got home, I was shunned, and I wondered, you know, what am I going to do, you know? And I remember it was the first time, really, in my recovery. I had 2 years, and I remember thinking, I really was thinking about getting loaded. And I was coming from Porterville, which is kind of poignant that I'm here. I was coming from Porterville, and I got to that corner there on Lover's Lane and Caldwell, where, you know, you could either, for me, I could have either gone straight and gone home, or I could have turned left and go to the bar. And I sat there, because it was late at night, thank God nobody was behind me, but I sat there through two lights. I was listening to Mariah Carey, and I was sobbing, you know, like, this is it, you know. And then all of a sudden, I just realized I don't have to give my power over to anybody ever again. I am not going to let this take me out. Because I wasn't the person that did something wrong. I hadn't violated anybody else. And I didn't have anything to be ashamed of. And then I started to get angry. And I don't know. There are times when anger is my best friend. You know, it sometimes gives me the fuel that I need to, you know, put my foot down and stand up for what I believe in. And in that particular time, it saved my ass. That is how I met my sponsor today. She was going to be a speaker at something that was happening in Tulare, and they needed somebody to pick her up. And so I get a phone call. Hey, our speaker's at the Kentucky Fried Chicken with this girl that's with her, and they don't know how to get to the place. Will you go over there and meet them and so they can follow you to the meeting? And I'm like, okay. And so I get to the Kentucky Fried Chicken, and okay, first of all, I am totally intimidated. I'm thinking, oh, holy mother of God, this woman is like been clean for so long, I don't even know how to have a conversation with her. And what ended up happening is, and if anybody knows my sponsor, there's like not a disingenuous bone in her body. And, you know, she was just so warm and welcoming and talked to me like I was just any other person, you know. Okay, duh, that's what we do, right? But it just speaks a little bit, I guess I'm sharing that with you because it speaks a little bit to my self-worth and how I tend to, even today, have negative thoughts about who I am and how I'm perceived. And there are still many times that I'm surprised when that isn't what I'm greeted with. I'm really touched by this Blues Fest committee. I want you to know that the reason that I signed up for this committee is because I went to that meeting for my husband. He had had surgery and he couldn't go. And he was going to try to get himself over there to open the door. And I'm like, are you fucking doing that? So I went to the office and opened it up. And what ended up happening really is that I just felt like I was wrapped in love by these people. And they wanted me to be a part of. And it touched my heart so much, I couldn't not. And I have to tell you that there's many times in my head I think, run! You know, I still have those times where I want to run. And a lot of it has to do with, I think that the older I get, the more sissy Lala I freaking get, man. Like all my game is like completely gone. There is no hustle left, you know, and I know that's what we're all supposed to be looking forward to, but I gotta tell you, at times it's like really uncomfortable. Because I feel like sometimes my feelings are having me instead of the other way around. And I've been really emotional this whole month, you know. I don't even know why. I haven't really deciphered that, so I'm not going to like get into it. But I think a lot of it just has to do with some awarenesses that I've had about the people around me and how much they love me and how much I rejected that and really ripped myself off from not having what I needed. So when they asked me to speak tonight, I was like, well, I'd really be more comfortable if you would have like two or three people that were an option and y'all could vote on it. And they, I'm like, okay, you know. And then we came back for the next meeting and they're like, we still need a speaker. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God. But how can you say no to a program that saved my life? So some of the things that have happened in my recovery, oh my God, there's been so many. There's probably not enough time, but I'll hit some of the highlights. So we're living in this house. My mom, my dad, my brother, myself, my son, my nephew. And very soon thereafter, my now husband, Rick. He was parolee at large and needed a place to live, and we took like a 2-minute vote. In fact, I don't even think I was there for the vote, honestly. And my brother said, you know, he's a really nice guy. He's going to end up going back to prison if he doesn't have an address. And so my mom said, sure, you know, tell him come on over. Well, then she got a call from his parole officer asking her if there were any firearms in the house. She got off the phone like, oh, my God, who did you invite over here to stay? You know. What ended up happening, though, I have to tell you, is that my mom and dad adopted my husband. They adopted him so much that they really had a hard time with us getting married, because my mom said, I don't know how I feel about you marrying him because he's like my son. And I said, but he isn't, Mom. Let's just be clear, there was no blood relation here, okay? Okay, it really isn't. So, like, whoo-hoo. And I got to tell you, I was kind of weirded out about it, too, a little bit, because my brother always had this rule that I was not to go out with any of his friends, you know? I don't know if anybody else that has a big brother, but it's sort of like this cardinal rule. The downside to that is I grew up most of my life thinking I was ugly because I never really went on a date with anybody. All of the guys became my brothers, you know? And so I guess that's a good thing, because then I, you know, really didn't have a ton of ego about what I looked like, but it kind of bruised my ego a little bit and wondering, like, how come everybody else has a partner? And so then when Rick and I started dating, actually, we didn't even know we were dating in the beginning. We liked to NASCAR races, and so we went to a race, and he bought my ticket, and I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And then sitting next to him at the races, I realized that my back was killing me because I was sitting so stiff. Like, you know, afraid I was going to, like, touch him or something, you know? And it's like, how come I'm feeling like this? Like, I couldn't even figure it out. So fast forward, a few months go by, I don't even remember how long, and this is when he was driving his dope-fiend truck. I think it was a Datsun, or was it a Toyota? Can't remember. It was orange in the inside and tan on the outside. And we were at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I was sitting in the truck with him, and I had been given some direction to talk to him about how I was feeling. Now, we hadn't even kissed yet. I know, bizarre for an addict. But we hadn't even kissed yet. And I said, I'm noticing that our hugs are a little bit longer, and it feels like something else is happening in our relationship, and I just want to know if you're feeling the same thing. And he said, yeah, I am. And I said, I don't want to start a relationship, because he had just ended his marriage, second marriage. And I said, I don't want to be the chick, because this is my pattern, okay? I'm telling myself right here. I don't want to be the chick that cleans up all your wounds, sends you out there to marry somebody else. Because that has always been my pattern. 2 or 3 months helping some poor guy, you know, clean up all the tears and all. Down to, like, coming and cleaning his house for him and stuff, you know, like, doing his laundry, like, playing house and shit. And then they're all well and everything, and then they go, bye. And next thing you know, they're marrying her, you know. So I said, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, you and I have been friends for a long time, and I don't want to ruin that either. And he said, relationships are too hard to start and too painful to end. I don't have any guarantee, but I would like to see where this would go. I get out of the car. I walk back to my car. I get in my car. Okay, there's no cell phone now, I want you to know. No cell phones during this time. I get in my car and I'm like, oh my God, what happened? What happened? What happened? I mean, I don't even think I said anything to him. I think I might have even just got out of the truck and like walked back to my car like I was in some sort of out-of-body experience. And then when I got home, I started calling people, and I'm like, I can't believe this really happened. Like, and so, and that's kind of how we got married too. Like, he wanted to move in, and I said, I'm not moving anybody in unless I'm engaged. It's got to have a ring on it. And I don't know, something of that nature. And he said, I'd marry you. So I let that fall on the ground, and I'm thinking to myself, was that him asking me to marry him? You know, so I have this, like, doping mind all night long. Oh, my God, what do you mean by that? You know, and I'm on the phone. I'm calm and confident. Oh, my God, this is what he said. What do you think he meant? You know, and so the next night, I was still doing hair, like I said, and he called me at the salon, and he said, let's go out to dinner. I'm like, okay, so we go to Sizzler for dinner. And across where we were sitting, I have to, you know, just picture this. There's like, okay, probably they were my age then, but there were these two old people sitting across the aisle. I'm thinking now they were probably 80, but, you know, they were probably my age, you know. And I said, did you ask me to marry you? And he goes, well, did you say yes? And these people over here are laughing. Like, they're just like, we were like their comedy show, you know. And I looked at the girl, the woman, and I think, and I don't even know her, but I'm looking at her like, are you hearing this right now? You know? And I said, come on. What? He said, well, yeah, I want to marry you. And I'm like, okay. Still, get in the car. My head's going, you know, what really happened here? And that kind of happened, that was kind of the same kind of out-of-body experience that happened for the biggest part of the beginning of our relationship. We had premarital counseling. And the therapist said, have you ever talked about your sexual boundaries? And I said, what's that? And she said, well, that's when you talk about things like if you go out and somebody asks you to dance and would your, you know, husband be okay with that? If somebody arrives at your home and he's not there, would it be okay if you let them in? If you go to an event and he's not there and you go with a group of people to eat or, you know, those kind of things. I'm like, oh no, never talked about that. Now, the other part is to talk about what you're comfortable with in terms of your body. That was exactly how I looked at her. Because, okay, Rick and I got a Cosmopolitan one time. Right? And it was asking you these questions. Oh my gosh. It asked you these questions about, you know, are you adventurous or not, right? How kinky are you, kind of thing. And one of the questions was, how do you refer to it? And mine was, down there. Okay, I've come a long way, just so you know. But that conversation, I have to tell you, from going from down there to talking about what I'm comfortable with, what I'm not comfortable with, you know, things you like, things you don't like that was never anything I did ever. There was always that just, you know, let's just go for it. And, you know, if it sucks, you just move on, you know. There was no real conversation. So, hence, I did a lot of moving on, just so you know. And, okay, honey, pound your chest a little bit. This is why I'm still married. Okay, so on a more serious note, oh my God, I'm blushing. So my son was 12 years old when I got clean, and so when my husband and I got married, he was a senior in high school. And I had this idea that I was going to have a dad for my son. And I want you to know that it's not really realistic to think that your husband is going to be a father figure for a boy who's getting ready to move on and move out of the house. He is already at a place, just, you know, to give you a heads up, this was my experience. He was already at a place where he wanted to be independent. So, you know, being like in this little family I was trying to create was really not in his radar. And so there was a lot of dissension in our house. I felt like I was the person in the middle all the time. I have my son, who is my best friend, my son, the kid that's been with me my whole life, and now I have this husband, which, you know, you should know that I had been divorced my son's entire life from the time he was 2 months old. So being in the middle of that while they're both pissing on trees was pretty difficult. And I kept trying to make them be like bonded, but they really, it wasn't in my power. That did happen eventually. My son calls my husband his dad. He doesn't have a dad, a biological dad. In fact, he never met his father. And his father actually died 2 years ago, and my son didn't even know it. So, you know, that has been a kind of a issue in his life. So my father was my my son's father figure. So when my dad passed, my son also felt like he lost his dad. So then here comes my husband, and he feels like he's being disloyal to my father by letting my husband into his life. So, you know, that was, I didn't even realize that that's what was happening, but that is what was happening, which is one of the things that happened in my recovery. My father got diagnosed with brain cancer. I had about 9 years clean, I think. And I was working, actually, over here in Porterville, and driving back and forth from my work over here to the hospital over there, and it was pretty horrible. I at the time I would have told you that I was much closer to my father than I was to my mother, and it devastated me when my dad died. But in 2014, my mom passed away. What ended up happening was between the time my dad died and my mom died, she was like my best friend. So I didn't just lose my mom, I lost my best friend. I mean, we talked on the phone every day, you know. I think I have a lot of her personality. She was real, kind of a clown and silly and, had a great sense of humor. I know I'm bragging about myself right now. I just realized that, but, I love that about her, that she, nobody was a stranger, you know, and, she loved recovering people. She was an advocate for people in recovery. She died sober and clean over 20 years. My father died clean over 20 years. And neither one of them went to meetings other than the meetings that they came to for me and my brother. They read the book. My dad especially had a spiritual awakening just from reading the book. My mom read the meditation book every day in the last 2 years of her life because she was in a lot of fear. She kept having strokes, and they were just bad enough that she would remember that she had them. And so she used that meditation book every day to deal with her fear of dying. And so, you know, when we talk about Narcotics Anonymous saving our lives, like, I guess I just want you guys to know that, like, the stuff that we learn about how to live, it transcends everything. You know, it helps everybody. You know, yes, it helps us. Yes, it helps the people around us. But my experience was that my parents... Yes, alcoholic, but also really benefited so much from all the literature that we had on the shelf. And about 5 or 6 years into, no, not even that long, it was less than a year into our marriage, my husband was diagnosed with hepatitis C, and at that time, they told him, you know, he'd probably need a transplant between 5 and 10 years. Went on the alpha interferon, which was horrible stuff. It was the first treatment for Hep C. And I watched him for over 6 months, basically looked like he was in heroin withdrawal. and sick all the time. And I felt so awful because I kept urging him to go to the doctor and get a physical because we had just gotten married. And I said, you know, I think you should like find out if you're okay. That was during the time where a lot of people were going to get tested for AIDS. And I said, you know, we're married. I think it might be a good time for us to do stuff like that for each other, you know. And so then the hepatitis C went away in the first... Well, 3 months he was on the medication, but almost immediately after he stopped taking it, it came back. And his viral loads was in the multi-millions, and he just said, I'm never doing that again. And so I put that back in my memory banks back here, but for a lot of the time, I lived in a lot of fear. For those of you who have been around here for a while, you know that a lot of people have been taken by that disease and this fellowship. And there was a lot of people dying. And we were living in this condo, I think, at the time. And I said, I really want you to reconsider being treated again because people are dying. And I don't want you to die. And so he reconsidered. We went to UCLA, and they did a full exam on him, and the doctor said, I think you need to have some other tests run, because in this particular situation, they set you up for a transplant in case you need it. And they noticed some things that were kind of alarming, so they sent him for some other tests, and one of them was to a cardiologist. And it turned out he had a 98% block in his descending aorta. And he was all, but there's a blues fest this weekend. I'm like, are you serious? You know, so yeah, he was serious. So they ended up having to put a stent in and open up his arteries, and there was I think they put a couple in, and then a year or two later they started to close, and they had to put a stent in a stent, and, you know. So there's been like this having to turn it over to a power greater than myself over and over and over again, not just in my own life, but for the people around me. About 5 years ago, I've been having like horrible migraines, probably about 15 a month. It was horrible. And, you know, of course, we don't take nothing for that, right? And I didn't even realize how much I wasn't functioning. But then I had some tests run and found out that if I didn't have neck surgery, I quite possibly could be paralyzed. And so I ended up having neck surgery. They fused four of my discs together, and it was pretty horrendous surgery. Worst pain I ever felt in my life, more than childbirth, which, since I only have one son, you can tell it was pretty bad. So I recovered from that, and a couple years later, went in for some routine tests, and in that test, they found cancer. And my doctor came to me and basically said I was going to die. And, I mean, that's the short version, but that's pretty much it. And Rick and I went through, I would say, the most difficult time in our marriage and in our recovery. When you talk about doing something one day at a time, when you've been given that diagnosis and you're waiting for a second opinion, it's more than one day at a time. Sometimes it's a minute at a time. and relying on prayer and meditation and phone calls to my sponsor and sling and snot in meetings, and finally found out, went to Stanford and found that, yes, it was cancer, but ultimately in the end it was early detection and I wasn't going to die. This was the doctor still on my fourth step. So I guess I just want to say that every single step of the way, whatever life seems to dish out, the main constant thing has been turning it over to God, letting go of control, accepting the outcome, letting people in. That's always a big one for me. Getting back into the steps. These last 2 years, I went back through the steps again with my sponsor. I got to step six, and then I said, you know, I don't think I'm done with step four. I had to go back and do some more writing. You know, there's never a time, I don't think, in anybody's recovery where the steps are no longer important. I think as soon as we stop thinking that we got to work a program, for me, I think it would be, if I decided that I wasn't going to work a program, it would be because I was deciding to walk out. And so if you don't have a sponsor, this is just old school, okay? In fact, I think somebody got a basket over here. My friend Ray might have brought it, I think. It's old school work the steps or die basket over here. And so if you don't have a sponsor, or you have a sponsor you're not using, you might want to make some changes to that. Or if you don't feel like you have the right sponsor, then you need to get one. And start following direction, because my best thinking got me in a lot of messes, and still today gets me in messes. So I don't know if I'll ever be done working a program. I guess my biggest goal is to die clean and with some kind of dignity. And I want to be thought of as somebody that shows love and compassion to people around me. There's been times in my recovery where I wasn't that loving and compassionate. In the step work that I've done recently, I realized that a lot of my acting out in probably the last 5 years was a lot of fear. Fear that I was, just like when I was new, fear that I was going to be rejected, fear that I wasn't going to fit in, fear that I was going to die, fear that my husband was going to die, fear that I was going to lose my house, lose my business, lose my friends. And I had to finally kind of get to a place where I can't live in fear anymore. You know? I just want to love people, and I just want to be loved. And I don't think that's anything that anybody in this room doesn't want. And I didn't find it out there using, and there really isn't anywhere for me to go. So that means I gotta do the work so I can stay. And I hope that, you know, whatever I said, I don't even remember what I said, half of what I said. But I hope that something that I said tonight might have touched somebody to not want to get loaded today. And if you haven't been working a program, I'm hoping something I said today motivates you to work it. So many wonderful people before me gave me love and kindness for no other reason but because they loved me and they wanted to be clean. And I think that's the least I can do for the people around me. So I think I've said all I want to say. Thanks.